Welcome to Getting Through It, where we're here to help you get through it. I'm John Buary, and as always, I'm joined with earthquake expert Dr. Lucy Jones. So let's get to it. Today, we're talking about how to manage all the news you're hearing about possible future earthquakes. And really, it's about how to understand how seismologists understand groupings of earthquakes and the way they talk about future seismic events. Lucy, your scientific research is about earthquake probabilities. This is your area of core scientific expertise, and much of the research done today on earthquake probabilities is based on your work from the 1980s. Instead of talking about theoreticals and modeling, let's go to the news of the week. This week, a report came out saying there is an increased risk on the San Andreas Fault due to the Ridgecrest earthquakes of July 4th and 5th of 2019. What does that exactly mean?
Well, first and foremost, it means there is one study that just got published that created a model of how those researchers think the probability is changing. And so it's a model, and it's not yet completely proven to work. Second factor, we need to remember it's been a year since the earthquake, and the ability of one earthquake to trigger another goes down with time. That's one of the strongest things we see in it. And so it's already been a year. There's a lot of risk that's already gone away. Third factor in this particular study is it's not saying that the Ridgecrest earthquake changed the San Andreas. It's saying we think there's been a permanent change on the Garlock fault that makes a Garlock earthquake more likely. And if we had a Garlock earthquake, that could set off the San Andreas earthquake. So it's a there's a lot of ifs that go through it. And I think the way I'd say, how do you think about this, is to say they're talking about relatively small changes in probability, and the long-term probability of having an earthquake is on the San Andreas is really very large. We, you know, everybody in the field, a consensus view is that it's about a 2% chance per year, that it's more than a 50% chance over the next 30 years that we're going to have a big earthquake on the San Andreas. And what that means is if you have not already included the risk of a San Andreas earthquake in your life, I got to ask you what you're doing in California.
The Garlock Fault. Why should we care about the Garlock Fault as it relates to the San Andreas? I mean, I know that there's more than 300 active faults in Southern California, let alone across the state and the Western U.S. There's, you know, all sorts of faults. But why the Garlock Fault related to the San Andreas versus, let's say, the Newport Inglewood Fault or the Hollywood Fault or the other faults that we hear about?
The Garlock Fault intersects the San Andreas Fault. So it runs, it's there near the Ridgecrest earthquake. If that ended up triggering an event on the Garlock, it would rupture down the Garlock and potentially rupture all the way to the San Andreas. And having a rupture come in near the San Andreas makes it more likely to set off another earthquake on the San Andreas. Because that's the most important thing about all this earthquake triggering. It mostly happens really nearby. You know, if I've heard that there's been an earthquake in, say, 29 Palms, I don't really worry about the San Andreas very much because that's far enough away, it's just unlikely to make a big difference. And the Garlock, if it stayed, when the Ridgecrest earthquake happened, we didn't see a really big increase in probability, or most of us didn't think there was a big increase in probability for the San Andreas because it was just too far away. And so this study said, hey, wait a minute, don't dismiss it completely. What if we had the Garlock and that could set it off? And it's like, yeah, that's a reasonable model. Going to happen now a year after the earthquake? That's pretty unlikely. This is interesting science that gets a good discussion going among the scientists. It's not something that's really got relevance to how you live your day or your year. What changes there might be are not enough to really be changing the behavior you should be having about a San Andreas earthquake.
You just said that it's just a model. What does that mean if it's just a model where the news is saying there's an increased risk?
Oh, and there's one of our really big issues, I think, about how science gets communicated. Because the scientific process is really a process of fighting with each other. It can be sort of cruel sometimes. It doesn't have to be. But one scientist comes up with an idea and they say, oh, I think this is the way it works. And I've, you know, pulled in some data or done some modeling. And they say, see, this is why you think it should be true. And another scientist will read that and go, Lord, that's bullshit. I can't imagine that's what's actually going to be happening. The stuff I've looked at says it's going to be something different. So they go and they look at the same problem with perhaps some different data or a different approach, and they say, that first one's wrong. Look at why mine's right. And then maybe the first author will go, oh, you forgot this other thing, and this is why I'm right. And that process can go on for a few years. And that's why it's so important to look at whether or not there's consensus. Because the point at which it's like, okay, the suite of models that scientist A came up with has just been a hell of a lot more convincing than the stuff that scientist B was bringing out. And scientist B finally sort of gives up and goes, okay, I'm not going to look at this anymore. And the rest of the fields go, okay, it really is scientist A's model is the one that works. That's a process that takes often several publications and time. So when you hear any of this thing, any of these types of things about probabilities, look for consensus. You know, if the U.S. Geological Survey issues it as a formal warning, perhaps together with the state of California, that's something that a large group has agreed to. This is something you can really act on. When it's a report on one study, remember that this is the process and it may or may not be the model that ends up surviving the process.
When we read news reports that say new model comes out, we got to be cautious of that word model, because that doesn't mean that everyone agrees.
Right. And, you know, think about it. Haven't you heard like, oh, coffee's bad for you. Oh, no, coffee's good for you. Oh, you can take 2 cups. Oh, you can drink 10 cups. That is different studies coming up with different answers, and it means we don't have a consensus in the field yet. I mean, actually, they're coming down to the way I read it, looks like coffee's really not bad, and I like it way too much to give it up.
So let's turn to another set of earthquakes that's garnered some attention and people are experiencing, and that's over in Puerto Rico. The last days of 2019 and into 2020, there was a series of earthquakes. It started with a 4.7, then there was a, I think it was like the end of December, and then it turned, the next day there was a 5.4, and eventually a 6.7 was the largest of this sequence. But then there's a series of aftershocks. So since January, and we're now sitting in July, there has been aftershocks, well-felt aftershocks of 5.0 or greater, a number of them. And people feel it, and it's more than 3 million American citizens are sitting there feeling these aftershocks, and it seems like they keep getting aftershocks, which we know can be unsettling. So what is that telling us about what's coming next?
Okay. I like to get it down to the basics. When you have a lot of earthquakes, you tend to have a lot of earthquakes. So the chance of another 5 in Puerto Rico, say through the rest of 2020, is a lot higher than it would have been if we weren't seeing that this was a large aftershock sequence. So let's take one moment to talk about aftershocks. Those are the most obvious type of earthquake clustering. Fundamental is one earthquake happens, it changes the stress, it makes other earthquakes more likely. Mostly they're smaller and we call them aftershocks. A few percent of the time you actually get an aftershock that's bigger than the main shock, and then we'll change the name and call the first one a foreshock.
And that was the topic, I'll just get in there. That was the topic of, I think, our third episode, the earthquake name game. If you really want to get into that,
right,
spend a whole episode talking about that.
Right. So we have this whole earthquake name game. Now, how many aftershocks are you going to get? That's actually very variable. When we look at the characteristic of aftershocks, get the statistics, we find how they die off with time is relatively constant. Some of them are slower decay than others, but it's not a huge variability. Then you see that they're mostly close in space, and the farther away you get, the less likely it is to have something triggered. That's why we weren't really worried about the San Andreas with Ridgecrest. But you also get, then the third factor is overall productivity. You know, for one magnitude 5, what's going to be your largest aftershock? How many, you know, if you have a magnitude 5, how many magnitude 2s are you going to have? Mm-hmm. Well, that one's really variable. It's what's called normally distributed. So you can look and see most likely, the most likely largest magnitude aftershock is 1.2 units smaller than the main shock. So if we had a 6.5 main shock, the most likely largest aftershock is 5.3. But a lot of them are bigger than that, and a lot of them are smaller than that. And there's this huge variability. I mean, I can show you a magnitude 6 here in Southern California that had no magnitude 3 aftershock. Right? So for 3 units of magnitude, no aftershocks whatsoever. And then you get things like this one in Puerto Rico, that you've got a magnitude 6.5 main shock, and we've already had like half a dozen magnitude 5s. The Puerto Rican sequence is normal, and we've seen lots of them before, but it's on the high side. It's probably in the top 10 or 20% in terms of total number of aftershocks given the main shock magnitude. You don't know ahead of time whether you're going to have a really big aftershock sequence or a really small one. We do have some research that suggests certain areas are more likely to have more aftershocks. Mostly you got to wait and see what you got. But once you've discovered that you're having a really aftershock sequence, like our fellow citizens in Puerto Rico are experiencing at this moment, then you've got to say this is an active aftershock sequence, so the chances of having even more are up. When you have a lot of earthquakes, you tend to have a lot of earthquakes.
So how do they manage that? How should they be thinking about that as they plan their next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months?
I think that one really important thing is recognizing that it's true. You know, they had a really similar situation in Christchurch, New Zealand a few years ago. So there was an earthquake in 2011. Actually, the first one was a 7, a bit out of town, and then they had a magnitude 6 aftershock that was right in Christchurch, and then they had repeated magnitude 5s like going on for almost 2 years. And I think we can look at what they went through as some important lessons. One is it is psychologically really traumatic, not knowing what's coming, and that there could always be another one. So, and then when you experience that aftershock, there's sort of this PTSD type of situation, remembering what the first one, how bad the first one was. So a really important first step is sort of the psychological preparation. Yes, it's really scary. We're going to get through it. They will eventually go away. And I think the other thing for Puerto Rico in particular, you know, they were very aware of their hurricane risk and have been more surprised by their earthquake risk. So this is now, okay, guys, sorry, but this is part of your picture as well. And much of the preparedness that one does for one disaster applies to the other. So, you know, when you're getting ready for your hurricanes, think about the earthquakes as well, and vice versa. And the basics of recognizing your society could be disrupted, that things you count on disappear for a while, that's what's important with both types of disasters.
You know, the both conversations, the Ridgecrest in Puerto Rico we were talking about, really talk about an aftershock sequence that comes to play when there's an earthquake. What about when we just sort of hear about, hey, they had another earthquake here? And isn't that a lot of earthquakes? Sort of like, I think about like Yellowstone. We always, a lot of news whenever there's an earthquake of a moderate size or a small size even in Yellowstone, or when Utah has a number of earthquakes. How do we take that into account when we think about what might be coming next in that area?
For a particular area, you're back to when you have a lot of earthquakes, you tend to have a lot of earthquakes. So, you know, Utah, on the long run, doesn't have that many earthquakes, but the fact that they just had one does increase the risk for a while. When you think about someplace like Yellowstone, it often gets really out of control because people are worried about setting off this volcano. You know, it's called a supervolcano because it had a really big eruption 700,000 years ago. That's where that name comes. It doesn't mean it has it now. Many of these places do have earthquakes, and in time they are mostly random, with this one fluctuation that you have one earthquake, you sort of increase your risk for a bit. We want to make the pattern because they scare us, and they'd be less scary if we knew why. Accepting that it's really random and it doesn't mean that much, you know, that's a question I get after almost every earthquake. What does it mean? And I tend to go, not a whole lot. It means that you have earthquakes. And you've got to think of it that way.
I can't leave this conversation until we talk about, quote, the Ring of Fire. People hear about an earthquake in this area, somewhere on the Pacific, and they assume it can trigger or is connected to an event halfway around the globe. We hear it all the time. Can you explain how people should react to statements in the media or in social media about the Ring of Fire? How do they manage those earthquakes as it relates to what might happen next?
Okay. When you hear Ring of Fire, think mythology. The name actually comes from before we had plate tectonics, and we'd see that there were all these earthquakes around the Pacific, and we didn't understand why, and it was a name to help us try to think about it. It turns out that there are multiple plates through here, and these are plate boundaries. But you know, when you have an earthquake in say the Philippines, that's going to be on the boundary between perhaps the Philippine plate and some Eurasian plate. And then when you have it here in California, it's the North American and the Pacific plate. So they aren't even the same plate boundaries necessarily. And there's sort of this folk belief that the stresses travel around the ring of fire and can be affecting each other. But in fact, we've looked for and never found any temporal correlation. When one earthquake triggers another, it's really controlled just by the distance away from the first earthquake.
So ring of fire, mythology.
That's it. Sorry.
Sorry to make it less dramatic, or a great movie title. Okay, here's what I'm hearing from you, that earthquakes come in clusters. And if it's in the news, whether it's a sequence that reveals higher probabilities, or it's talking about like, oh, there's an earthquake in Yellowstone, we don't just need to read the headline. It's really about reading the whole story and really getting into the idea of what is really being said. We know that headlines sell. You know, 40 years ago, it was right. The headline that was selling a newspaper. Today, it's the headline that's selling, or the click, if you will. So we got to dig deeper on those headlines.
Well, the headline probably doesn't tell you very much. And what you want to look for is this a consensus opinion? There are a few things like aftershock triggering where we go, okay, that we really understand that. Most of the others are going to be models of one scientist or maybe not even a scientist. I mean, I saw some big headlines out of a novelist going for the Ring of Fire. So, you know, you could make sure you're looking and saying, oh, this is the consensus of the scientific community. Before you go any bit farther on that.
And the other thing you said is, you know, earthquakes are random. I think we have to remember that earthquakes are random. Even with sequencing and the probabilities, they're still random. You have a higher aftershock sequence, a lower one, as you discussed.
Well, and even when we have an aftershock rate and it's dying off with time, the time of any individual event is still random within that. We call it random about a rate. But just when we're having aftershocks, the rate gets so high that you can guess pretty well. I remember about noon on the day that the Northridge earthquake happened, there was a press conference, and somebody asked me about aftershocks. And I said, there's probably going to be another magnitude 5, because at that point, it was such an active sequence. And in fact, we had another dozen magnitude 5s, I think, after that. But about 2 hours after I said that in this press conference, there was a magnitude 5.6 in Simi Valley. And people going, look at you predicted the earthquake. And I was like, yeah, and I can predict rain in Kauai as well. When the rate gets high enough, you don't need to know more information. And so look for those rates, the timing of any event, even when we do have information, the timing of any individual event is random within that pattern.
So how do you deal with it? What do you tell people? How do you deal with the randomness? Especially around earthquakes, but in so many things that we're dealing with. What do you do? What do you tell people to do?
Well, I think the randomness of earthquakes, when you realize the tricks your mind is playing on yourself, you can stop it. We want a pattern, because if it followed a pattern, it would be less scary. So when you see something and, oh, is there a pattern? Remember, you know, we've never been able to find one that actually stood up to scrutiny. So, you know, it's that tendency, when you go to guess a pattern, recognize that that's your psychological defense mechanism rather than real evidence that there's a pattern there. And I sometimes have to remind myself of this, you know, when I see, oh, wow, did you see that earthquake at Mompong? Isn't that pretty weird? You know, there's been 4 of them now on the Basin of Range. And it's like, yeah, well, so what? Even if it is a higher rate, then it's, well, you got a slightly increased chance of another one. You don't know where. You don't know when. So recognize your own psychological motivation to do that. I'll make one exception on this, though. The one time I really notice an earthquake is if it's right next to the San Andreas Fault, because the San Andreas is both capable of the largest earthquakes in California. It's also the fastest moving fault. So on the long run, it has more earthquakes than the others. And for something to be a foreshock to a San Andreas earthquake, it has to be right at the fault. Like where we started, you know, if the Garlock Fault does rupture and it comes into the San Andreas, well, we better recognize we have a significantly increased risk for the next few days after that happens. Or if we see an earthquake in Cajon Pass, right, the San Andreas and San Jacinto, or Palm Springs. But if it's out in the desert without a big fault around, it's just less likely.
Well, we know that we're going to have another earthquake. It's inevitable. It's random, but it's inevitable. And so we'll be back talking about it again, helping you get through this. And so until next time, I'm John Bueri with Dr. Lucy Jones and you, Getting Through It. Getting Through It is a production of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Visit us online to get past shows and become a supporter at patreon.com. That's patreon.com and search Dr. Lucy Jones. There you can get extras, insights, and access to the world of Getting Through It. Our music is performed by Josh Lee, and this closing music is written by our own Dr. Lucy Jones.